Western Wisconsin is a full of peaceful rolling hills dotted by lush farmland and dense forests. But in Pierce County, within the town of Rock Elm, there are hints of a violent and tumultuous past. To the layman, it doesn't look any different from other sloping hills and valleys, but to a trained geologist, there is evidence of a massive impact from space, massive enough to change things at the atomic level and create one of the rarest minerals on Earth. We'll talk about the Rock Elm meteorite crater, the recent discovery of redite, and what it all means this hour on the West Side. I'm Rich Kramer, and joining me are two geologists who have spent considerable time and effort studying what's known as the Rock Elm Disturbance, or Rock Elm Meteorite Crater. First, I'd like to introduce the man who discovered it all, Bill Cordua. I hope I pronounced that right. Bill is an emeritus professor of geology at UW-River Falls, and he joins us by phone. Bill Cordua, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, nice to be here.
Good to have you. Welcome to the West Side. Next, I'd like to introduce Aaron Cavosi. Aaron is an associate professor of geology at the University of Puerto Rico Mayagüez campus, where he joins us by phone. And by the way, it's according to Google weather, it's 82 degrees there right now. Aaron Cavosi, welcome to the West Side.
Thanks, Rich. Good to be here.
Good to have you. And listeners, we'd like to hear from you, too. I know there's a lot of science aficionados or science lovers out there like me. Give us a call at 800-228-5615. A truly remarkable disturbance, crater, what have you, geological formation right in our backyard, and the fourth place on Earth where redite has been found. The number to call in with questions or comments is 800-228-5615. So, Bill Cordua, I'd like to start with you. When did you first have a feeling that there was something special about the Rock Elm area?
Well, that's an amusing story because just like I know everything important in my life, my wife told me. when we came up here, she had some geology courses, and she took a soils course down at UW-River Falls. And they took her on a one-day field trip, and they stopped over Rock Elm and said, "This is the worst soil in Pierce County." And she noticed it was developed on a shale she didn't recognize from other bedrock around here, and she saw some tilted rock. So she came home and she says, "You know, Bill, you ought to get over there and start figuring out what that is because it's anomalous." And so so I started working in the 80s. The anomaly had been known since the 30s, but nobody really understood the extent of it. And so I basically could go over there, use some student help, as well as it's only 45-minute drive from my house, so it was very easy to pop over there and walk around and plot where the rocks were and what they were and to try and start to figure it out.
So what are the anomalies?
Well, in that area, you'd expect the bedrock to be the slimy rock, Prairie du Chien rock at that elevation, but within the structure where you see Prairie du Chien rock, it's bent up or broken. And there's a shale there that doesn't match anything else outside the structure. And there's a sandstone on top of it that also doesn't match anything outside the structure. And then there's this middle part where rocks that ordinarily should be hundreds of feet below the surface are at the surface. In fact, it's the kind of sandstone you've got right over there in Eau Claire called the Mount Simon sandstone. Mm-hmm. Well, it slants to the west, so what you have at the surface should be deep underground by the time you get over here. Well, it was popped right up to the surface, so everything was out of place. And by mapping it, it became apparent that it was within a confined, relatively circular area. And that was really the beginnings of trying to understand what it could be.
So at that point, do you think, aha, this has got to be some kind of a meteorite crater?
At the time, in the 1980s, the acceptance of impact structures on our planet was not really that well accepted. And a lot of people were explaining these by having some mysterious gas bursts from the interior. So I entertained both hypotheses at that time when I published my original paper. But I was able to document the major features. It really, at that time, did look to me like an impact crater, but it didn't have the the compelling evidence at that time to prove it. That came along a bit later.
All this material, with your hypothesis that this might be an impact crater, before you found a smoking gun, at least then, explain to us like some of the anomalies as far as the shale and whatnot, the fill, what was happening there?
Well, it's something, in this case we know it's the impact of an asteroid or comet, something that basically just blown a hole in the normal rocks, and a lot of that had been just tossed out, maybe miles, vaporized, blasted into powder and thrown away. And so you have a nice big hole in the ground. What happens during an impact, the middle of that structure also pops up right away, which is what why the Mount Simon got there. But essentially, it's a hole in the ground. It probably looks something like an angel food cake pan, with the high middle part, but a very low area, and low areas don't last very long without filling up with sediments. But since there wasn't a low area anywhere nearby, those sediments only accumulated within the rock elm feature.
But where did the shale come from, and where did all this sediment come from? I mean, what did this area look like at the time?
Well, these were deposited in an ocean. We can find fossils in there. They're marine fossils. In other words, they're things that live in the sea, like shellfish and marine worms and other types of things. So at some point after the crater formed, and maybe soon after, the sea came in and just basically filled it up, washing sediment in from the surrounding highlands were.
So any idea how far, the sediment might have come from? To be deposited in this crater?
Well, that is a little bit hard to say. You have to figure out what was actually above sea level at that time. Mm-hmm. Central Wisconsin was probably more or less above sea level, so you go over to the Wasatch area and so forth. You have granites and other kinds of rocks over there that could have been shedding sediment into this basin.
Okay. And at the time, this shallow sea, you found fossils. What kind of fossils are we talking about? You mentioned some marine life. Are we talking there's fish?
Yeah. There are actually quite a few fossils once you start looking for some of the smaller beasts. Some of the larger fossils are shellfish that we call brachiopods, and there's also some clam-related fossils. But the things that were really helpful to us to figure out what age this were the jaws of worms. There are all these little marine worms that swim around in the ocean, and mostly they don't get preserved because they're basically just soft-bodied. But some of them have these little jaws made out of phosphates, and so when they decay, these little jaws get mixed in with the rest of sediment. And they're really pretty handy because we can use those fossils to sort of correlate when this might have happened. So if you know the age when the sediments were washing into the crater, and you know the age of the rocks that got messed up by this event, you can pretty well bracket when this event happened.
So we're talking how long ago, generally?
Well, probably around 470 million years ago.
I mean, and at this time, I understand that what we know as Wisconsin was not, cold and snowy. You mentioned it's an ocean, but it wasn't even in this part of the Earth, right? It was near the equator?
Right. It was near the equator because, we can blame continental drift for that.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to kind of relocate where we were. So if you think about something maybe the Caribbean or that type of environment, and then when the seas would vary in elevation, they'd come in and out. And sometimes this area was probably exposed to the air, and sometimes it was sort of buried under a sea that might be, 50 or 100 feet deep water.
Hmm.
So the sea would come in and go out, and so that's when it was in here, we would deposit the kind of sediments we see all around us in western Wisconsin.
We're talking this hour about the Rock Elm meteorite crater and a discovery of a super rare element, or super rare mineral, that is, called rhyodite. We'll get into that in just a bit. The number to call in is 1-800-228-5615. We'd love to have your questions and comments. On the phone with us, we've got Bill Cordua. He's the Emeritus Professor of Geology at UW River Falls, the man who is credited with, he and his wife, I guess, first discovering this this crater right in western Wisconsin. And we're going to also be hearing from Aaron Cavosi. He's an associate professor of geology at University of Puerto Rico, Mayagüez campus. Had a team of students in western Wisconsin and found riedite, a very, very, very rare mineral. 800-228-5615. So, Bill, you mentioned that you started piecing this evidence together and you started getting an idea of what must have happened. And there were some naysayers. What wouldn't they believe about that?
Well,
other than the fact that I guess they didn't believe that impact craters were a thing.
You know, there's if you go back to the 1930s or 40s or so forth, we really didn't recognize we had so many, extraterrestrial visitors throughout geological time. So the idea that that even what we now call Meteor Crater Arizona was an impact was pretty much discredited. You know, people really didn't believe that. That had begun to change with the Apollo missions. Mm. But there were still some diehards that say, no, you got to make this from some sort of powerful, weird volcanic burst in the interior. So when I published my paper, I entertained both hypotheses. But then I got a visit from a geologist from the Smithsonian named Bevan French, who was an expert in impact structures, and he took a detailed look at some of the quartz grains and the material that got pushed up in the middle, and he found these unusual deformation structures in the quartz that are really only produced by the kind of energy from an impact. And that's what I call the smoking gun. When we uncovered that evidence, then we could publish and say, hey, this really is an impact crater rather than some sort of a weird volcanic burst of energy.
So the material was shocked. I mean, in layman's terms, what does that mean? Is it crushed?
Well, yeah, essentially. When you make a shockwave, you're talking about a concentration of energy that is much more powerful than a lot of forces that that ordinarily people would think of as powerful. The kind of a hypervelocity shockwave that would create the kind of structures we were finding, it actually takes more energy than you get from a volcanic eruption or a big earthquake or any of those kind of events that you associate with violent geology. This was even more violent. You needed more energy to produce these.
Mm-hmm.
So there's really not any other way to do that except having some object from outer space traveling at really supersonic speeds suddenly hit the Earth traveling at supersonic speeds, and all that energy gets released one time in one place.
So what kind of sampling did you have to do to kind of determine how large this crater is, where the rim of it was?
Well, that was just basic field mapping. You just plotted out where you had the shale or where you had the normal rocks, and just by plotting them on a map, you could find where the boundaries were.
Okay.
And that was pretty much established really pretty early on. We had this circular anomaly, and we could see the size of it. Now, the funny thing is, people are going to, people travel over there, they think you're going to see this huge hole in the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Really, that's filled in. It's really hard to recognize what it is unless you actually start going around picking at the bedrock.
Right, right. And I saw a video that you had put together, and some of the places aren't very easy to get to, i.e. they're private property. So word to the wise out there, don't be skulking around on people's property.
Yeah.
So this thing is how wide in diameter, basically?
Well, the anomaly is about 4 miles from one end to the other, whether you go east, west, or north, south. It is pretty close to a circle.
Okay. And is there any idea of how deep it is now that it's filled in? Can you estimate something like that, and also estimate how fast or this object was traveling?
Yeah, well, what we need is somebody with a lot of money to go over and drill some more holes for us there, and we can probably see where the bottom of it is. But you can sort of reconstruct. This is one of the things that Dr. French was able to do based on his work, that this was a crater that was probably about 4 miles wide at the start, and the original crater was probably about three-quarters of a mile deep. And then stuff from the side would sort of slump in and stuff, and when the sea finally got back in there, it would sort of fill it up.
Okay.
These things usually travel, just as an estimate, maybe 12 miles per second.
Hmm.
And if this was an ordinary asteroid that we would call maybe chondritic, you make some assumptions about what it's made of, you could do this with something that was maybe about 200 yards in diameter coming in from outer space.
Wow.
So the thing would make a crater much bigger than itself, but still, if you think about 100 yards of the football field, so if you multiplied Lambeau Field by two and have this thing shooting in from outer space at 12 miles per second, that could make you a pretty nice 4 mile across crater.
Yeah, I guess. But there's no evidence of any kind of this wouldn't be big enough to cause any kind of extinction or any kind of widespread die-offs or something.
Yeah, this isn't as big as the impactor that, let's say, wiped out the dinosaurs and other things about 65 million years ago. So it's not, it's big, but it's not enormous in the terms of being what we might call a dinosaur killer. But there is another angle there. This period of time, about 470 million years ago, is when quite a few of these craters were actually being formed. There are a number of known craters that formed at just about the same time, extending all the way from Sweden even down into, there's one even known down in Oklahoma. There's one up in Lake Superior. And these, it's hard to say that they formed at the same time, but they formed in about the same, period. So that was kind of an active time for impact in Earth history, with about 470 million years ago.
One in Lake Superior, I'm curious, where's that? Because I'm from right up on the shore.
Sure, it's called the Slate Islands, and it's in the sort of northern part off the Ontario coast.
Very cool.
Yeah.
You're studying things on the ground here. Any idea? Have you talked to any astrophysicists or I don't know who you'd talk to determine why this might have been such an active time?
There are some ideas floating around there, but you're speculating, you're hypothesizing.
Yeah.
But one idea was that there was a major asteroid breakup that just threw a lot of unstable fragments flying through the solar system.
Must have been a wild time in what we now know as Wisconsin and across the world. And real quick before we take a break, are there any other impact craters like this within Wisconsin or the Midwest that are nearby that people might be able to check out?
Well, there are. Actually, Rockham's the easiest to get to because there's a county park nearby. But there's one called Glover Bluff. There's another one down near Pepin that's probably very similar to it. There's one down in Decorah, Iowa. It's very similar to Rockham feature.
But as far as age, is this one of the older ones?
Well, the ones I mentioned are probably pretty close to the same age.
You just said that. Okay. All right. Well, let's take our first break. When we come back, we'll hear from Aaron Kavosi and open it up for discussion with both he and Bill Cordoa. We're talking about the Rock Elm meteorite crater and the recent discovery of a mineral known as riedite. This hour on the west side. Number to call in is 800-228-5615. Phone lines are wide open, and you can get right online with these scientists and pick their brains. This is the West Side. We'll be right back in just a bit. I'm Rich Kramer, and you're listening to the West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us this morning. We're talking science. We're talking geology. We're talking Western Wisconsin, specifically the Rock Elm meteorite crater, which is in Pierce County in Rock Elm, which is near the Ellsworth area. We've got two scientists geologists on the program right now who have studied this. Bill Cordoa, we just talked to, Emeritus Professor of Geology at UW River Falls. And joining us by phone from Puerto Rico is Aaron Kavosi. He's an Associate Professor of Geology at the University of Puerto Rico, Mayagüez campus. And now, Aaron Kavosi, I'd like to ask you, how did you first get introduced to the Rock Elm crater, and what about it is intriguing to you?
Hi, Rich. There's just a whole lot that's interesting about Rock Elm. The reason that I wanted to go have a look at it is actually not because it's such a large feature, but actually because it's rather on the small side of sizes of impact craters. Before working at Rock Elm, I have been working at large impact craters in South Africa and up in Canada that are several hundred miles across. And so these are just gigantic features that you could easily fit cities in. And the technique that we like to apply at these other large sites is understanding how an impact crater erodes with time. When they first form, as Bill was talking about, it's a pretty violent place. It's highly energetic. You've got this big rock coming in from space, and at the speeds Bill cited, you know, it's coming in at 10 or 12 miles a second, and all that energy gets transferred into the whatever the rocks are on the surface of the Earth. And literally, in as short a period of time as a few seconds, those rocks that get hit and this big incoming rock vaporize, and much of this material is thrown back into the atmosphere, some of it a long ways, some of it just falls right back down locally. And so a tremendous amount of rock gets highly affected by this process. A lot of topography forms. Bill talked about a big hole, and sometimes there's a raised central feature. And so all of a sudden, just the shape of the Earth in this area gets modified a lot. Some material's now sticking up where it wasn't before, and there's big depressions. Well, when you change the surface of the Earth like that, all of a sudden, the way the Earth erodes acts the same, and it starts working on eroding these rocks down. The interesting thing that we're after is looking at very small features in the minerals that record this energetic process. We call these shocked minerals, and it's what led ultimately to the discovery of this unusual mineral. But at the other sites that we're working on, typically what we do is we're interested in looking at for the presence of these minerals in sand as these as the rocks from the impact structure erodes. And so what my students and I will normally do is we'll go to one of these impact sites, impact crater, and we'll collect sediments from the rivers that are eroding these rocks and carrying them to other localities. Because we had been working at large features, large craters, for the last several years, we decided to test a different hypothesis at Rock Elm. And we wanted, when we first went to Rock Elm in 2011, we wanted to see if we could detect a record in the sediment eroding from Rock Elm. If Rock Elm as a feature was making a record in the sediments, you know, could we find some of these shocked minerals that occur in the rocks that Bill was describing that had been subject to these unusual conditions that only impact craters create, and they forever change these minerals? We wanted to see if we could find those minerals in sand, and that's why we first went to Rock Elm.
Okay. And we've got a caller on the line that has a question about readite, so let's spill the beans. I was kind of trying to lead up to it and tease it as much as I could, but if you could, Aaron Cavosi, what is it?
Readite is what happens when you shock metamorphose a very common mineral called zircon. For the people out there that think about elements, zircon has zirconium, silica, and oxygen, and zircon is just a wonderful common mineral in granites, and when the granites erode, it goes into sediments as a little grain of sand. Any beach you go to will typically have some amount of zircons. You normally won't be able to see them because they're small, but they're tough. It's really hard to erase them to nothing, and so they tend to be concentrated in sands over time. The rocks that Bill was describing in the center of the Rock Elm Impact Crater is the Mount Simon Sandstone. Because it's a sandstone, it has lots of zircons that were present before the impact. And the impact produced such high pressures and temperatures that some of those zircons got compressed. It's as if you put them in an incredible vise just for a fraction of a second. And that's all it takes to rearrange the atoms. And so readite is made of the exact same elements as zircon, Zr, Si, and O, zirconium, silica, oxygen. But under those pressures, the atoms rearrange to a tighter structure, a more dense structure, and we can detect the presence of that mineral intergrown with some of the zircons. Redite only forms through meteorite impact processes. No other natural process on Earth is known to form this mineral.
All right, we've got that background. Now we've got Jesse in Balsam Lake. You're on the air. What's your question?
Thank you for having me. I was wondering if Rita was worth anything since it's so rare. Is there any money value to it?
Well, that depends on if you're a collector or a scientist. If you're a scientist, it's fascinating, but and it helps us sometimes generate some more funding because of the interest for this. But if I were trying to go make a buck, redite wouldn't be a good investment. The amount of the material that we found, you could put a lot of it on a period at the end of a sentence. It's that small. The size of the minerals that we found are much, much smaller than a human hair. And they're very easy to identify and locate with sophisticated microscopes. We shine electrons from different kinds of electron microscopes that we use to collect pictures and also to analyze the arrangement of the atoms to verify that it is indeed redite. But the quantities we're talking about are extraordinarily small. We're talking smaller than milligrams, probably on the order of nanogram quantities of this mineral. Incredibly small volume.
What you're saying is that
it wouldn't pan out. It wouldn't
pan out, no. If you tried to pan it, you wouldn't eat too well, I'll tell you that.
All right, Jesse, thanks for the question, or thanks for the call. Number to call in with questions or comments, 800-228-5615. We're talking about the discovery of redite. It's a super rare mineral that is created through extreme heat and pressures that happen when a meteorite impacts the Earth and turns zircon, changes the atoms. It's just fascinating to me. And this all happened right in our backyard in Rock Elm, Wisconsin, in Pierce County. 800-228-5615 to ask a question to Bill Cordova or Aaron Cavosi. So, Aaron, your students were in town looking for the traces in the rivers of these minerals that had been shocked. So you're basically just digging up sand. You're not pickaxing any kind of sandstone or anything like that?
That's right. This isn't like Raiders of the Lost Ark, where we have a big team and the blowing winds and the tents, and we're out trying to rush to dig up the treasure before the sun sets. It's a lot of science. It's a lot calmer than that.
Mm-hmm.
To do our studies on the sediments, we wade out into some of the local drainages, some of the local streams with small hand shovels, kind your wife might. Move potting plants and potting soil around with, and literally dig up some fresh sand. It's wet. Our bags are full of water at the end of the day, and we take home a couple of pounds of sand from each of these sites. If they're on private property, we go talk to the landowners. The fellow that owns the land where the redite was found, he thinks this is a pretty neat thing. He's not a geologist at all, but this is kind of adding to the natural heritage of the site. Some of the times where the streams are on public lands, where they cross roads, we just pop down under a bridge and bag up a little bit of sand, take it back to the laboratory, and go through the tedious process of drying it down and separating out the majority of the sand, which is quartz, from the minerals that we're interested in. It's kind of a fluke about discovering the redite. A lot of interesting things in science sometimes are found on accident. When I was there in 2013, it was the second trip of mine to Rock Elm. I was visiting Rock Elm with some students that were visiting themselves with me, the University of Wisconsin-Madison, as part of a NASA astrobiology summer internship that I operate with faculty at UW. And it's a fun program because I take some students from Puerto Rico up there every year, and the students engage in astrobiology research. And that kind of makes the crossover with impact cratering studies, which is why Rock Elm is interesting to astrobiology, because one of the questions astrobiology is how did life come to be, both on Earth, elsewhere in our solar system, and even beyond our solar system? Right now we know that there's something on the order of 2,000 planets that have been confirmed to exist outside of our solar system. And that's just an astonishing thing. These aren't speculative planets. These are ones that have been confirmed by measurement. So it becomes the question of how life develops, perhaps when in the evolution of a planet are the conditions right for life to develop. These are now questions that a lot of people are trying to get good answers with, firm answers, so that as we point telescopes up into the sky and we see these 2,000 planets and that number's growing constantly, if we want to send a robotic explorer to one of them or a spacecraft or something like that, we can tell a lot about the age of some of these, and so we might be informed about what potential targets to go explore if we can do studies on Earth that inform us about when life might have arisen on Earth, or at least when the conditions for life might have arisen. This brings impact cratering into the equation because the early part of Earth was dominated by meteorite impacts. And we also know that this process overlapped with when science thinks life began. And so if we can understand the interplay between when the young Earth was getting bombarded by impacts and it was a very energetic environment, parts of the planet may have been molten, probably not the whole thing very often, but certainly parts of the Earth. We also know that conditions for the establishment of life also took hold. So the early Earth was pretty dynamic and a very interesting place, quite different from what we're used to. And understanding how to read the impact cratering record, where it's better preserved, like at places like Rock Elm in Wisconsin and other localities, helps us look further back in time. And so the trip I took these students on was to go see what a deeply eroded impact crater looks like, because Rock Elm is very, very different today than it was when it formed. The well-defined shape and the morphology with the raised rims and the raised center, they're much, much subdued. As Bill said, it's kind of rolling hills out in Wisconsin that looks a lot like other rolling hills out in Wisconsin today. It's not obvious that there's an impact structure there. Without the careful detective work that Bill did, no one would know this exists.
Even with a topographical map, I just found a generic one online, and it doesn't look any different than anything else.
Mm-mm. No, there's very little evidence from the morphology of what it actually is.
Yeah, Bill Cordova.
If you look at Google Earth, you can kind of spot this.
Really?
Nugget Lake is at the top, south edge, and the reason is that there's a little bit of a different land use inside the crater because of the shaley bedrock in the soil. So there is a kind of a circular anomaly you can pick out, and if you just Google Earth to Rock Elm and just pan out a little bit so you can see Nugget Lake, and you sort of see this more treed area in the middle, and that's it. So it actually does show up from space. Of course, we didn't have Google Earth back in 1980.
No.
So, you know.
I'll tell you what, I've spent hours just messing around with Google Earth, and I'm definitely going to check out Nugget Lake in Rock Elm. When Bill, you said a different land use, so trees in the middle because it's not great for farming. Farmland surrounding it, is that what you mean?
There's farmland surrounding it. There's a lot of glacial drift and more of our normal soil, so you see the more normal farmland, and then you see this area where it's more heavily treed, and there's not the quantity of corn and soybean fields in that.
Okay.
So the soil reflects the bedrock, and then the soil determines, you know, how the land is most profitably used by folks.
Man, that's something. So, Aaron, your students, are these graduate students, or is this just some students that happened to luck out and get this internship?
No, these were undergraduate students.
Wow.
They came out with me for the summer, and we were only in Rock Elm, that area, for a day.
Okay.
And what we did was mostly collect sediment samples, but I wanted them to look at the rocks that were present. And it was when we were out looking on the land that we had access to, private land, that we found a couple outcrops of rock. There's not a lot there. It's kind of isolated rocks. It's mostly hilly forests. It's quite a pleasant area to walk around in. And it's when we found a couple unusual rocks. And I wouldn't call them souvenirs because we're scientists out doing work. But we found some rocks that look like broken up sandstone. And scientists call those breccias. Bill actually described breccia in his first paper, which was the first I had learned that this kind of broken up shattered sandstone was present. And we found a piece of it, and we collected it, and we took it back to the lab to see if we could do an identification of what kinds of shocked minerals were in it. Ultimately, it was that sample that we found redite in.
Hmm. And I don't want to jump around too much, but Bill, this video that I saw that you had put together explained how the sandstone, because of the nature of the shallow sea, the sandstone should be nice flat layers, but around the rim in certain parts of this Rock Elm crater, it's all messed up. It's just twisted and busted up, right?
Right, and these are places where the crater fill is eroded away enough that you can see a little bit of what's underneath it.
Sure.
Best place to see that is a little place called Nugget Lake Park, and they have a trail going back to a feature called Blue Rock, which is, you can see some nice bent-up limestone there. And they have a guidebook, too, that shows some of the, that tells you how to get to some of the geology sites. So where you can see the normal bedrock, it's not normal. Something's happened to it, obviously.
Right, and at the time there wasn't a whole lot of geologic activity happening in this area, or in general, I guess?
Yeah, you have to go back way, way long before there's anything like mountain building or volcanic activity or anything else. This area's been quiet and stable for many, many millions of years, so there wasn't the kind of things that you see happening in Hawaii or in the Rockies or anything like that.
And Aaron Cavosi, you took this souvenir rock back, and what's the process that you and your students have to go through to kind of check it out? Do you got to bust it up, drill, shave some off, or how does that work?
Well, a little bit of shaving. We took the rock back to the lab, and I had an undergraduate student named Ashley Ann Arana, and her project for a semester, she's an undergraduate student, was simply to evaluate if shocked quartz was present in the rock. Quartz is a pretty common mineral in a sandstone. It's what makes up most of the sandstone. And so the first question was, we can't just assume that this rock has something to do with the impact structure. Glaciers passed over this region, and so there's a lot of material that's been moved around.
Mm-hmm.
But this was an unusual rock, and so the easiest first steps were to simply see if shocked quartz was present in the rock. And so back in the lab, you take a rock saw and you cut a few slices of bread, if you will, off the end of the rock. And from these slices of bread, you shape a smaller little piece, and ultimately you glue that on glass. And then you shave that down until the amount of rock that is glued onto the glass slide is about half the width of a human hair.
Hmm.
And at that point, you can shine light through that rock sample, no matter what minerals it contains. And that's how geologists then identify those minerals with a microscope. And so I had a student work on just two slides from this rock, and it was a wonderful project because immediately she was able to locate many different grains of shocked quartz in this rock, and immediately we knew it was a part of the impact structure. Here's evidence for that high-pressure shock deformation.
Hmm. Very cool. And you're looking through it, scanning electron microscope, is that right?
That came a little bit later.
Okay.
Let's see. Her project would have been, in the fall of 2013. And in December of that year, boy, that was just 1 year ago, my goodness, I took two other additional students to Madison from University of Puerto Rico and to work on kind of a little bit more of their projects they were associated with at the time. And I actually didn't go to Madison to work on this Rock Elm sample. I had some other priorities at the time, but I did go to Madison to use a scanning electron microscope. So I had these two students there. Oh, gosh, was it cold. We were all bundled up and enjoying the weather in December in Madison. But what I had done was I stuck these two glass slides in my pocket when we went to Madison, and I told myself, you know, if you have some extra time, you can take some images of the shocked quartz grains that the student had found with the scanning electron microscope. And it was just an add-on project.
A whim.
This all would have been last December.
This, you know, I said it kind of like a whim.
Yeah, sorry, I thought you said win. Yeah, it was absolutely a whim. That's a good description of it.
Huh.
And because I had some other work on the electron microscope that was a higher priority. And I didn't have any anticipation of additional findings from Rock Elm. We had documented that our rock was shocked, and we were moving on to other things. But when I stuck the slide into the electron microscope at the very end of that trip a year ago, I took a few images of the quartz, and I had a little extra time on the instrument, and I said, you know what, a mineral I like to study a lot is zircon, and chances are there could be some zircons in this sandstone. Let's see if we can see any of these. And as soon as we change the mode and how we are imaging to look for zircons, boy, there was a lot of them that showed up all at once. And it was the process of looking at some of these zircons is when we identified the redite.
So, and if it's too complicated, maybe it's not worth getting into, but what does redite look like on a scanning electron microscope?
Okay, it stands out, I'll tell you that. When you're using one of these electron microscopes to look at different minerals, the elemental makeup, meaning what elements are in those minerals, can influence how they appear. So with this electron microscope, we used a kind of imaging called backscatter imaging. And essentially, minerals that elements in zircon result in it showing up as a very bright object, a very, very brilliant object in the images. Quartz, which only has silicon and oxygen, shows up as a little bit darker of a material. So in a way, when you're zooming around on your glass slide and looking at the different mineral grains that are present, you can adjust the settings so that the sea of quartz that dominates the sandstone is kind of a dark material. And every so often, you see a bright headlight. And when you zoom into that bright headlight and look at it in detail, you can see, well, here's a zircon. And that's kind of what we did. We were zooming around in the dark looking for the bright headlights, finding the zircons, and when we would see one of those, we would zoom in on the grain. Many of them look very normal. They look like the kind of zircon you might find in an igneous rock, like a granite. And ultimately, that's where many of these must have originated as sand grains. They eroded from rocks and then were deposited in the sandstone long, long before the impact. Well, a few of these zircons look different, and the ones that had redite had an intergrown mineral in it. And the way it appears, because the redite is made up of the same chemical elements as the zircon, it's also bright. But there's a twist. Because redite is a denser mineral, because those atoms are packed closer together, it has a noticeably brighter appearance than the zircon does. So we had been calibrated in how we were imaging these zircons to, you know, okay, here's zircons. They all look pretty much similar and normal. And then we started finding grains that had very bright materials that are streaking through them. And when I say streaking through, you can think of it as planes. So here's all these very straight features that are absolutely parallel. And what they are little sheets that are oriented all in a row, and those are the planes of redite that formed as a consequence of just a part of that zircon becoming more dense and recrystallizing into this new mineral. And so it kind of looked like a zircon that got sent through a couple rounds through a circular saw, and where the saw cut through it are these bright phases. It was very obvious that something unusual was going on here. That was the indication, but that wasn't the confirmation that it was redite. That came later.
Well, let's take our final break. I've been putting it up because I'm just fascinated by all this. We'll be back in just a second. We'll close out the hour with that final confirmation and also what it means, you know, for the field and perhaps for Western Wisconsin. I'm Rich Kramer. We're talking about Rock Elm redite this hour on the West Side. We'll be back in just a bit. I'm Rich Kramer. You're listening to the West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about the discovery of riedite, an extremely rare mineral, only found three other places on Earth. The fourth place it was found right here in western Wisconsin in the town of Rock Elm, population 528. I'm joined by two men who have been studying this Rock Elm meteorite crater. Bill Cordova joins us by phone from River Falls. He's Emeritus Professor of Geology at UW-River Falls. Aaron Cavosi is joining us by phone from Puerto Rico. He's an Associate Professor of Geology at the University of Puerto Rico, Mayagüez campus. All right, Aaron Cavosi, I didn't mean to cut you off, but you were looking through this. You saw the headlight, then you saw the bright, bright zircon that had some streaks through it, and you could tell that it was riedite. What was the final aha?
I've been working on zircon for years, and at this point, all I knew is this was something unusual. And come the spring of just this year in March, I passed that sample, that slide, to a colleague at the Lunar and Planetary Science Conference in Houston. And that colleague took it back to Western Australia at Curtin University. So this little thin glass slide got sent to the other side of the planet. And some colleagues at Curtin University, Nick Timms and Timmons Erickson in the Department of Applied Geology, they used a sophisticated electron-based method called electron backscatter diffraction. And that's a method that actually analyzes the spaces between the atoms in minerals, because that spacing is a unique indicator, a unique identifier to be able to determine exactly what mineral you're dealing with. And when they analyzed this glass slide, they confirmed directly that this was, the suspicion was correct. This was riedite.
That is fantastic.
That was a big happy party.
Yeah, I guess. So, I mean, what are the implications? And Aaron, I'll start with you, and then I want to go to Bill to see, you know, what his thoughts are on the fact that this another smoking gun found in his crater, not his crater, but the crater that he helped discover. What's the big deal? Riedite, okay. Fourth place on Earth, why is it so significant in this ancient crater?
You know, when you find new things you're not anticipating, especially in areas that have been underfoot for a long time, it makes them that much more special. When Bill first found out this was an impact crater, all of a sudden these low-lying hills in western Wisconsin became a lot more special back then.
Mm-hmm.
It's had that status for a long time, but now the status of Rock Elm has been, in one sense, elevated again to join a very elite club of impact structures, of which there's only four, where this very rare mineral has been found. The significance is not just notching up another locality. At least in my mind, the significance is that here we found this mineral in a very common rock type. It's never been found in sandstone before. Sure, the sandstone is shocked, but shocked by the impact, that is. But there are a lot of impact structures, including some of the ones that are similar in age that Bill was talking about across the U.S. and Canada, that are also in sandstones. There's impact craters of much younger age that are in sandstones. And I might be wrong, but I get the sense that sandstone is, because riedite had never been found in this kind of rock, something's never found there, the chances are you're not going to go look for it there purposefully.
Mm-hmm.
And now that we've identified this recorder of even far more extreme impact conditions than what was known previously at Rock Elm, that tool could be applied to many, many other localities to try to recreate the impact conditions and better understand the effects on the surface environments of some of these impacts. I'm interested in pushing this very far back in time and seeing if we can find much, much more ancient riedite as a way to understand the conditions on the early Earth. But everyone's got their own take. That's one of the things I'm interested in.
Fantastic. Bill, we're close to the top of the hour. What were your thoughts when you heard about this discovery?
Well, I was delighted. I talked about the quartz being a smoking gun. Well, this I call a sort of a booming cannon, because it just additionally supported the idea that this was an impact crater, so the other hypothesis could just pretty much go away. And I'm very happy that Rock Elm is that additional research is getting done over there. It's fairly well exposed for something its age. and it's exciting that other people are motivated to come in and take what I've done a little further.
So does this change Rock Elm? I mean, are we going to see teams of researchers from around the world? Is this going to become some kind of a research hotspot?
Well, I don't know. It's hard to say what people will do, but you know, there is more stuff that can be done over there to look at what its deeper structure is and some of the other aspects of it. So I hope this encourages more people to come in and work.
Excellent. Gentlemen, thank you so much for your time. That's our time for the show. Bill Cordura is the Emeritus Professor of Geology at UW-River Falls, and Aaron Cavosi is the Associate Professor of Geology at the University of Puerto Rico Mayagüez campus. Thank you both so much for your discussion. That was fascinating. Thanks to Team Westside, including Mort Cypress, Henry Lippel, Dean Cullenbeck, and many more that I'm forgetting at the moment. Next week, we're going to be talking about cranberries. In fact, there's too many cranberries, and prices for going to farmers are very low. So low that they asked the federal government to buy $60 million worth or 60 million pounds of cranberries, that is. We're going to be talking with cranberry farmers and a person from the cranberry industry. That's next week. Until then, have a safe and productive week. Thanks so much for listening to The West Side.